The Theosophical Society in America presents Joy Mills, The Important Principles of the Secret Doctrine, Tape 2.
In the Secret Doctrine, the web of the universe is woven. As weaving, of course, is usually associated with feminine activities, this motif is normally found in the myths in which the feminine plays a very major role. For example, in Plato's Timaeus, and Plato, of course, refers to a lot of myths in his dialogues, as you know. In the Timaeus, the myth of the goddess Nemesis, where it is said she sits in the center of the cosmos, and the axis of the cosmos spins around in her womb like a spindle. And then there's the image of the creative power as a smith, blacksmith. A verse in the Rig Veda, for example. Even as a smith, the Lord of Prayer together forged this universe. In the earliest ages of the gods, from what was not, arose what is. And elsewhere in the Rig Veda, the Creator is spoken of as a carpenter. And Jesus was a carpenter's son. So we have this concept of in the cosmogonic process of the builder, or builders. And the Secret Doctrine, of course, is full of builders. You know, you're going to have trouble sorting them out unless you really make a list of them. But there are a lot of builders there. You know, I mean, it takes a great number to get this thing going. An interesting sidelight, of course, on this motif or archetype of the craftsman is that occasionally he's too hasty and the result is either an incomplete creation or some problem arises. There's an Islamic text, marvelous Islamic text, on the creation of Adam, for example, which is the representative, the archetype, which is going to be representative of our humanity at this particular stage, the Adamic humanity. I said Adamic, not Damic. In which it said that when Adam was created, he lay around as a lump of clay for 80 years. And then Allah gave him human shape. So he lay around, but he still didn't have any breath in him. The soul was lacking. And so he lay around for another 120 years. Allah is rather slow in this process, in this Islamic text, you see. It's not as swift as Jehovah in Genesis. And finally, after 120 years, Allah breathed the breath of life into him. But the breath didn't completely fill up Adam's body. He wanted to stand up. He wasn't able to do so and kept falling down again. So in the Quran, there is a very interesting statement in the Quran. Man was created in a hasty manner. I mentioned last night that we're half-baked, you see. So we really are half-finished. And there's a marvelous story in the Judaic tradition, in the Midrash, in which Isaac asks God, you know, you've done all of this, and you've said, you've created the firmament, and you said it was good, and you created all the plants and animals and so on, and you said these were good, and everything you did, you said was good. But when you got around to creating man, you didn't say he was good. If you read the Bible, you'll find that, you see. Wherefore, O Lord, says Isaac, you know, how come this situation? And of course, God answers Isaac. Naturally, because God is within him. The auriferous quartz is full of the gold, you see. And God says, because man I did not make perfect, but gave him my laws by which he would perfect himself. Marvelous statement, you see. This is why I say, this is the whole symbolism that we are indeed furthering the entire process. Our work will further the process. Well, then there's a wonderful motif, an archetype of creation, concerning the image of creation as a sacrificial act, as though something has to die for the new to be created. In the Chinese mythology, for example, the whole creative process is seen as a murder. And in Norse mythology, we have the primeval giant Ymir, from whose body the entire world was created. It's marvelous. And in the Eddas, From the flesh of Ymir the world was formed, from his blood the billows of the sea, from the hills from his bones, the trees from his hair, the sphere of heaven from his skull. Out of his brows the blithe powers made Midgarth for sons of men, and out of his brains were the angry clouds all shaped about the sky. Everything in the universe is this divine reality, fragmented, murdered, as Osiris, as Dionysius, as Prajapati. You know, all, there are so many myths. In certain early Jewish traditions, it is said that the first man reached from one end of the world to the other, so that he is indeed, this is the sacrifice on the cross, you see, spread out through the whole world. And in Hindu cosmogony, we have the primordial man, the divine Purusha, who is cut up in the act of creation, a sacrificial act, with each part of him becoming a part of the universe. And as I say, we have in the great mystery schools, Osiris cut into 14 parts, now to be reassembled by the goddess Isis. Dionysius, the great Dionysian mysteries of Egypt, of Greece, Dionysius is cut into 14 parts. In Hindu mythology, Prajapati, the father of the gods, that which originated the whole system, cut into 100 parts, and so on. So it's a sacrifice. And we repeat that. We make holy this whole process, which is to sacrifice. And we leave ourselves wherever we have been. There is some part of ourselves there. We cut ourselves up, and then we reassemble ourselves, you see. So this, again, is the image of the archetypal heavenly man. Well, a seventh feature that can't be overlooked is that in almost all cosmogonic myths, creation myths, there is a subjective aspect which I have called thirst. It's a mood, a subjective longing, a desire which leads to a kind of fear of loneliness, a hunger, a thirst. This is well represented, of course, in Tantric Buddhism as the necessity for sexual union. And, of course, often many of these great sculptures in India are taken as merely pornographic when they are representative of this high principle of a union of that which appears to be separate, these two, you see. In this category, we have to include an image that's particularly present in occult cosmogony, the concept of tapas, which means to brood, to warm, to give warmth to an inner seed, to engender by heat. And we have this not only in the great yogic texts in India, but also in many Gnostic texts in the West, perhaps akin in one sense to the scientific model of creation by explosion from within outwards, the Great Bang, the Big Bang theory. There is an intense heating, you see, which must then express itself, a thirst which moves outwards. And in connection with that, you see, we have another archetype, which is the eighth there, the germ or egg on which the Godhead brooded and from which the world was produced. We have this very clearly portrayed in Hindu mythology, and we find it, therefore, creation is a mighty tapas, and you have this in the Rig Veda. It's a meditative concentration of thought, hatching the world egg, or Hiranyagarbha, as it's called in the Hindu mythology. In the Khandogya Upanishad, for example, in the beginning, this was non-existent. It became existent. It grew. It turned into an egg. The egg lay for a time of a year. The egg broke open. The two halves were one of silver, the other of gold. The silver one became this earth, the golden one, the sky, the thick membrane of the white, the mountains, the thin membrane of the yolk, the mist with the clouds, the small veins, the rivers, the fluid, the sky. The egg is a tremendous archetypal image. One finds it in all cultures. And sometimes, you know, if you're I find this, at least, when I'm writing, for example, because my own expression, I guess, is through writing. I certainly am not a painter or sculptor, but there is a kind of brooding within on an idea until it hatches, until it opens, until it flowers within. And there is an intensity, you know, and then it opens. In the Chinese text, the I Ching, for example, hexagram 61 identifies the egg with the sign for inner truth. Inner truth that is revealed. It's also associated, of course, with the idea of concentration, that is tapas or brooding, which is really a self-reflection, a bending back upon oneself, and a warming through the concentration of energy. And so within that archetype is the motif of separation, a division in the primal unity. The egg is split open, often into two parts, but sometimes a fourfold division. And we find this, you see, even reflected in physical biology, in the biology of the cell division, mitosis and all the rest, isn't it, you see? So it is reflected even at the physical level. So we have this motif in a primal separation. Father, mother spin a web, and then they are separate, you see. We have this in number symbolism, you see, in which there is now a separation and a multiplicity. Well, quickly, the ninth is that generally from this archetype of separation, the egg breaking open, the one is always there, no matter what the division. The egg is always present. We have it in the concept in the Gita, with one portion of myself I pervade the universe, but I remain. The one is always there. And that's what HPB is saying, even though she tried in vain to convince us of it. That's what she's saying. But from that, then, there is a tremendous motif that appears, which I've called chain. I don't know what to call it. We have the archetypal image of long chains of generations, numbers, particles. Numerous myths list lengthy chains, then, that move from this one. Chains of generations of gods, ancestral beings, divine powers. You know, in the Bible, all the begats that appear, you know, this lengthy chain of generations. The principle, if you like, of hierarchy, which HPB defines. In the Secret Doctrine, there's a reference to the army of the voice, you see. So you may not like chain, use army, whatever you like. And HPB speaks of the host of the Logos, adding, the esoteric theogony begins with the one manifested, therefore not eternal. This is the second one. It is from this, of course, that all the numbers, she says, procreating and multiplying in unison with the unit one, that the whole universe proceeded. This is a complex structure. When you consider the complex structure of protoplasm, for example, or the DNA, you know that the formula for DNA is an extremely long one, an extension of one primary substance in a number of permutations of the one. So it's reflected even here at the physical level. And finally, a motif that we must mention, a very important one, there seems to be in many mythological texts, and it's repeated in the Secret Doctrine, which can only be called the motif of failure. We are not assured of success. But that's all right. There have been many abortive attempts. In anthropogenesis, you come upon goat men and watermen, terrible and bad, and all sorts of things, you know, which had to be destroyed. They were failures, you see. Early attempts to create. Every mythology actually has reference to abortive efforts, efforts which have to be destroyed, or which result in a kind of wrong creation of titans or dwarfs. There are numerous failures, but that's all right. I think, you know, I mean, what is a failure? I'd rather be a great and glorious failure than a mediocre success. Because a failure means you've attempted something more. Just to be a success means you're already doing what you can do, which is silly, I think. Why not, you know, be great and glorious failures? Because then what is pointed out is that there's always a chance to begin again. Yes, yes.
How we wish to engage in the creation of something better for our species, someone seems to have to die.
Yes, isn't it interesting that again and again the advances in humanity, the advances in consciousness, in awareness, have often come through the death, you see. And in many religious traditions, there are many who have commented that the essence of the entire Christian story lies not in the life of Jesus, but in his death. That was the transforming moment. That's interesting to contemplate as a part of the mystery tradition, whether you accept the historicity of Jesus or not. I'm not concerned with that, and I'm not intending to argue it, but that it was the death of the Savior God. Of the life, yes. That this is the crowning of the life, that something has to die for something new to be born. So this motif of sacrifice is very much present, and it's present in the secret doctrine, incidentally, in the whole cosmogonic process. Most what? Yes, they are. Yes. Yes, they're not all within any one myth. This is the thing. And generally, myths are parts of this, you see. And so I wouldn't say that they're all present within what we may call the Christian myth, if you're thinking of the life of Jesus, for example, as the myth. Yes, the Judeo-Christian myth. You see, I think you would have to include the Judeo-Christian myth. And I think you find it there, you see. St. Paul, for example, speaks of the unknown. Isn't that right? And this is implied in the first chapter of Genesis also, an unknown underlying the entire process. And again, Jesus himself, in some of the sayings, whether they were his or attributed to him, you probably know that there is a six-year study in progress now, the Jesus Seminar, it's being called, which is investigating or trying to study the historical records with all that now has come to light to see which were and which were not the sayings, the authentic sayings of Jesus. Fascinating, of the studies that are going on in Christianity today. So there is an unknown. The second chapter of Genesis is indeed a mirror principle, and this is very much present, you see. One finds this also in a kind of twinning, I and my father are one, a mystical saying. So man was made in God's image, the image principle, the mirror principle, the reflection principle, yes. An awakening, you see, the baptism is an awakening, isn't it? The... I would think so, yes, in one sense, yes, the cloning of Eve, the feminine principle, you see. Although it's reversed, you see, in what we have as the exoteric tradition. This is not true in the Zohar and some of the sacred books of the Judaic tradition, which are not as well known. In the Kabbalah also, the Kabbalistic tradition, to which H.P.B. refers again and again. It is the feminine from which emerges the Sephiroth, the whole Sephirothal tree, in the Kabbalistic tradition. So one has to look very carefully at the whole corpus of the tradition, which includes, of course, the Gnostic, and then you get into what is really Christian and what was brought into it. You see, you get this in the Manichaean tradition, the twinning, very much, which was became the heresy, and was thrown out. The Albigensian heresy, the Cathar heresy of the 12th century, nicely slaughtered. Talk about sacrifice. You know. The Cathars were neatly slaughtered, you see, by edict of the Pope and so on. And yet somehow the whole Albigensian movement did survive. You find fragments of it. For example, in Tristan and Isolde is the whole Albigensian, the Cathar tradition. Either Cathar, they really were Cathars, the word Cathar meaning pure. And it came from this place in France, Albigensi, and so they were called the Albigensians. But they are, you know, really they were Cathars, that is pure. And so you get the whole tradition kept in the myth of Tristan and Isolde in its original form, which was, of course, later put down, or within that century put down by Gottfried von Strasbourg, who must have been an initiate in the Cathar tradition, I suggest, anyhow. Anyway, that's another story. These things all fit together. You begin to find them. The Creator is very much the archetype. The fact that Jesus was a carpenter's son is this tradition, you see. Joseph was the carpenter. So he is the second one in that sense. Recognized as a builder. Sacrifice is, of course, central to it. This longing, I think one finds very much in some of the Gnostic traditions. This thirst, this longing. The Gnostic... I can't at the moment say the particular school of Gnosticism, but there is a school of Gnosticism that puts the whole subject of the emanation that God so loved the world. Of course, you get this too in the Christian scripture, that he gave his only begotten son. That there is, you see, this thirst, however, that God was love, God is love. Love must have, therefore, its object. Love is not love until it is projected outwards. And so this is the thirst and the whole Gnostic tradition in one of the schools of Gnosticism. Sorry, I don't remember the names of all the schools. I bring all the notes with me. But anyway, you will find it, that love is not love. This is the universal principle. And so there is a longing that arises, a thirst, a desire, and projects itself on the universe, which it embraces in the in a kind of total embrace. The germ or egg, well, that is, I think, very much present in the whole tradition, the Judaic Christian tradition, that there is that which, by warming flowers, by the heat, the intensity, the concentration. Certainly you get numbers, begats, all the begats of the Bible, you know. Representative, and you get it in the Christian tradition, St. Paul, virtues, principalities, powers, dominions, angels, archangels, my God, they're all over the place, aren't they? You know, all of them, the long number list. Hierarchy might also be a word you could put in there. Yes, hierarchy is also a word, and HPB uses this, and the doctrine of hierarchy is very important as a central principle in the whole process. Failure, well, I suppose it's there behind the scenes somehow.
The Noah tradition,
you see. Yes, the Noahite tradition that, after all, you know, but something was kept, and that's the point of failure. And in the Hindu philosophy, it's, and you'll find this in the secret doctrine, there are the shishtas which remain, the seeds which remain. Yes, in a sense, the Eden story, paradise is lost. Well, what I'd like to do now, if you're not too tired and worn out and so on,
is at least to move back to these seven stages of the cosmogonic process as given in the stanzas in the first volume of The Secret Doctrine. Then we'll keep this middle part for tomorrow. And what we were going to talk about tonight as Maya, we'll take up first thing in the morning, and the second part of the morning will be on the tattvas, which comes on quite naturally. Bev?
Could you go on? Could I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know enough to know.
Mm-hmm.
As I listened to all that we heard tonight, I asked myself,
very good question, Bev. Should we be listening to this as natural history, as history in the ordinary sense of the word, or as allegory? I prefer, frankly, that it really is allegory, that it is myth, that it is representative of psychological facts of our own nature. That if indeed, as I suggested this morning, and as the Secret Doctrine indicates, the pattern is the man pattern, then it is all within us and to be realized within us. On the other hand, there is some historical basis for certain of these allegories, legends, myths. So it does have that. Let me point out, for example, there is certainly the tradition, and even as late as Plato, the tradition is maintained of the sinking of vast continental masses, land masses, known as Atlantis. And certainly there is this long tradition of changes in the land masses of our planet. This is certainly historically, geologically evident, you see. And HPB, for example, in the second volume, points out that there are seven continental land masses, the first one of which, she says, is an imperishable land mass, the imperishable sacred continent, the sacred island, the imperishable sacred land. Further interesting. Now, a lot of speculation has gone on as to where that is and so on. And it would have to be something that was never underwater, for example. Now, that's should be identifiable by the fact that you would find no fossil remains of underground creatures, I mean, underwater creatures, no fossils. And there are very few, if any, places on the Earth that have been explored where there are not fossils, which indicates a submergence at some time, you see. Now, this to me has posed quite a problem. And many years ago, one of our really outstanding scholars in the society, now dead, E.L. Gardner, wrote quite an article. I can't even give you the reference, but it's ages ago, in the Theosophist somewhere, on the imperishable sacred land, suggesting that this is indeed part of a true myth. That this is perhaps not necessarily a physical land, but that it is indeed, since it was the home of the first root race, or this first developmental stage, that it therefore was not physical matter, any more than the first developmental stage was dense physical. Therefore, how could it be physical? However, as physicality came, then what happens, you see? There has been no evidence of the existence, for example, in spite of the Atlantic Ridge, of any lost continent under the Atlantic Ocean. Meanwhile, there has developed in geology, in this whole field, the whole theory of the plate theory, the tectonic plates. Now, this to me is extremely exciting, and this is why I said last night, some knowledge of science, even a layman's knowledge, is useful. And one needs to keep track of these things in all sorts of fields. And I suppose because I'm an omnivorous reader and have a kind of
mind that, you know, goes out with its tentacles, a kind of octopus mind that sucks in, you know, like the tentacles of an octopus, gets hold of these things and brings it in. I read everything, you see. But I try to read, I must say, not just the wafty things that go by the name of science, which are pretty pseudoscience, but really pretty solid stuff. And happily, within the society, we have members who have a background in these various sciences. For example, a very good friend of mine in Australia is Dr. Victor Gostin, who is a professor of geology at the University of Southern Australia in Adelaide. And so I could discuss this with him. I have the advantage of having traveled all over the theosophical world and contacting these members hither and yon all over the theosophical world. So I know these people. You know, it's a nice advantage, isn't it? Well, what is being suggested under this new plate theory is that rather than simply the submergence of areas, there's a reformation, you see. The plates meeting, for example, the rise of the Himalayas is two plates meeting, which are still meeting, and though the Himalayas are still rising. So if you haven't gotten around to climb Mount Everest yet, I mean, you better do it sooner, it's going to be even higher. You know, I mean, after all. Or, if you like, the Ozarks are going to get shorter because they're much older. You see, the Black Hills of South Dakota are very, very old. And so you can wait a while and they'll get down to the level of Nebraska. You see, you know, and you won't have to climb much at all. Stick around long enough, you know. So in other words, there are parts of these plates which formed different continental land masses, which have now moved about. And it is now known, for example, from geological stratification, that there are parts of the state of Idaho that are similar only to parts of Alaska, not to neighboring areas. So this brings in another possibility in my fertile brain, another possibility. And that is simply that we may even now be standing on landmass that was once Atlantis, once part of Lemuria, and that will be, you know, maybe off there in the Pacific by the time something comes up there and the tectonic plates move. And my good friend Maxine here tells me at dinner time that in all places they had an earthquake just recently in Cleveland, Ohio. My old hometown, you know. I was born and brought up there, you see. And much prefer California now, but in any event, you know, people say, why do you live in California? It's earthquake prone. Well, why should I have stayed in Cleveland? It's earthquake prone. I mean, I might as well, if it's going to be an earthquake, I might as well be comfortable under a palm tree in California than freezing in Cleveland Square downtown, Cleveland. You see, isn't that right? So, perhaps we have to rethink. Now, remember that this theory was not present when HPB was writing. She had to write within the context of the knowledge of her time, at the same time hinting at a reality that went beyond that knowledge. But what other language did she have? And she had to utilize that knowledge. But this whole new theory of tectonic plates, I think, solves the problem that we're confronted with. You see? Neatly solves it, perhaps. A recent work within the last year or so, a couple of years, is a translation from an ancient Tibetan text. And, of course, more of these are coming out now because of all of the mass of texts that were brought out of Tibet at the time of the leaving of the Dalai Lama and the many, many lamas and people surrounding him from monasteries when they came into India. Well, a recent translation of one of these has been done by Dr. Herbert Günther, who probably is one of the foremost Tibetan scholars, a professor at the University of Saskatchewan, Saskatoon in Saskatchewan. And he has translated this text, whose name I don't have here, but the translation is under the name The Matrix of Mystery. And I hope you have it in the library. If you don't, you ought to have it. It is an absolutely an amazing work. And it parallels so the secret doctrine that to me it is really quite incredible. The Matrix of Mystery, incidentally, is man himself. He is the Matrix of Mystery. And in that, he suggests, I mean, the text suggests a triplicity underlying manifestation from the primordial one. There are three modalities, as he puts it, of pristine cognitiveness. Don't think this is an easy book to read. Because if the Tibetan was difficult, believe me, I think Ginther chooses the most difficult English words he could find. So you really struggle through it, but it's marvelous. It's worth struggling through, The Matrix of Mystery. And so there are three modalities of pristine cognitiveness. This is the pure knowingness, the pure cognizing, which is to know with one's total being. That's the Matrix of Mystery. And one of these modalities he calls resonating concern. Resonating concern. This, of course, is what leads to compassion. Compassion not as an attribute, as the voice of the silence so rightly says. Compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws. I do have the one sentence that I really think is marvelous in this. In each body of every sentient being, in each body of every sentient being, there resides pristine cognitiveness, tending towards its coming into presence. It coils itself up in its own bed, which is the continuum of being, the spontaneous there-ness of being. What a magnificent. That's the translation of one of the shlokas in the Tibetan text. And the Matrix of Mystery is indeed man. But in each body of every sentient being, there resides pristine cognitiveness. This is the auriferous quartz, if you like, isn't it, of HPB. Tending towards its coming into presence, that is its exhibition. And this is the whole process, is the exhibition of that pristine cognitiveness. It coils itself up in its own bed, which is the continuum of being, the spontaneous there-ness of being. Often we say, for example, that this is, and we use the Greek word, chaos, that this, you see, and this I'm reminded of, this spontaneous there-ness of being, which is this, in the Greek philosophy, chaos. Now, we have such a strange idea of chaos. I talked a bit this morning about how words get changed in meaning. And when I use chaos, what comes to your mind? Confusion, disorder, and so on, which is not what it means at all. Chaos, this is the tragedy of it. Chaos is related to the English word yawn. And that's indeed what it means. In German, it has become gähnen. You know German? In the Indo-European languages, this is, and it's and you get this in the Norse mythology that Ymir, the creative principle, yawned. Incidentally, you also get this in Alice in Wonderland, which is not a children's book, but a very profound occult novel. You know. So chaos is simply that void which is yawning. And yawning does a great number of things. So it's not disorder, it is pre-order. Because when you yawn, so now you see it, maybe it's good to talk about this at this time of night, you see. You can go ahead and yawn and you can see what happens. What happens when you yawn? You see, there is a breathing in and breathing out. There is a relaxation, isn't there? But more than that, a ring pass knot is immediately created. Is that right? A ring pass knot. A limitation has been imposed in which everything can now occur. Someone in one of these groups spoke about the development of language. When you yawn, you see, the first sound is ah, ah, ah. The vowel sounds. It is with, then, all of the other aspects of the mouth, the tongue, most of all, the tongue, the lips, the teeth, the soft and hard palates, that the yawning is given order. Chaos is ordered. So this is pre-order. And speech then, and God said, you see. Because this is really the next step, is then the speaking, which is only possible out of chaos, the yawning, the fullness of the void, the seeming void, and the voidness of the seeming full, and so on. I can't remember the exact quotation, but HPB uses this. So don't think chaos is disorder or confusion. It is pre-order. Everything is possible now. But once you have begun to limit it, only certain things are possible. Chaos, therefore, is usually related to darkness. Because in darkness, everything is possible. Once you put on the light, it limits. It's not light that releases. I always remember, and some of you may have heard me use this, because I do use it again and again. I'm awful on repeating certain things. But you may remember a long time ago that novel by Han Su-yin, Love is a Many Splendored Thing. You remember that? Beautiful novel. She describes in there her experience during the war. When she was walking across the darkened air pad, the airstrip at Chongqing, China, everything dark, and of course towards the airport building where all of the black curtains were down and so on. She's walking across this absolutely dark, black airfield and enters the airport room, which is brilliantly lighted. And she says it was not that the light revealed so much more